Hi, my name is Brendan Malone and you're listening to The Dispatches, the podcast that strives to cut through all the noise in order to challenge the popular narratives of the day with some good old-fashioned contrarian thinking. You might not always agree, but at least you'll be taking a deeper look at the world around you. Hi everybody, welcome along to another episode of The Dispatches. Thanks for tuning in again for another one of these musings from the front lines of culture and society. Today I want to tell you a story, a true story, a very important true story actually, about the life of a man called Ignaz Semmelweis. Now, a lot of people listening to this podcast are probably immediately thinking, who? Ignaz who? It's I think, one of the great tragedies, really, is that I imagine outside of the world of medicine, I think if you've studied medicine, you've probably at least heard of this man's name, but outside of the world of medicine and medical science, that Ignaz Semmelweis is not more widely known, because his contribution, although very simple and straightforward, was actually profoundly important to medical science, to the practice of medicine, and to the world in which we live in today, in fact, and take for granted. His contribution was huge, but it took great courage and heroism before that contribution to the world in which we live was even accepted as valid. It's a very timely tale, a cautionary tale that is extremely relevant for the times that we find ourselves living in. And like I said, it's a real tragedy that not more people know this man's story. As I often like to say to people, in my best or worst, I guess depending on how you look at it, attempt at a dad joke and a reference to Star Wars, all the Star Wars fans will get the following lame dad joke. Have you heard the story of Darth Pelagius the Wise? Well, what about Ignaz Semmelweis the Truly Wise? Hey, you didn't come here for the humour, so I'm not even going to apologise. But Ignaz Semmelweis is a name that should be more widely known, but he is not. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to introduce you to this man and his life, and I'm going to do that by referencing the Encyclopaedia Britannica entry, the biography in full, about this man and his very important exploits. And then I'll end with just a tiny bit of commentary at the end. And I think you'll appreciate why he might be so important. A man for our times, we might say. So let me start the article. Ignaz Semmelweis, in full, Ignaz Philipp Semmelweis, or in Hungarian, Ignach Fulop Semmelweis. Apologies to anyone who speaks Hungarian, because I've probably just butchered that. Was born on July the 1st, 1818, in Buda, Hungary, the Austrian Empire, now Budapest, Hungary, and he died on August the 13th, 1865, in Vienna, Austria. He was a Hungarian physician who discovered the cause of perpetual childbed fever and introduced antisepsis into medical practice. Educated at the universities of Pest and Vienna, Semmelweis received his doctor's degree from Vienna in 1844 and was appointed assistant at the obstetric clinic in Vienna. He soon became involved in the problem of perpetual infection, the scourge of maternity hospitals throughout Europe. Although most women delivered at home, those who had to seek hospitalisation because of poverty, illegitimacy, or obstetrical complications faced mortality rates ranging as high as 25 to 30%. It's quite astounding when you think about it, isn't it? Some thought that the infection was induced by overcrowding, poor ventilation, the onset of lactation, or miasma. Semmelweis proceeded to investigate its cause over the strong objections of his chief, who, like other continental physicians, had reconciled himself to the idea that the disease was unpreventable. So first point to probably stop and note is you've got a situation where those in authority are not really interested in what this man has to say, and there is a consensus about this particular disease, and in this case the consensus was that it was untreatable. Semmelweis observed that among women in the first division of the clinic, the death rate from childbed fever was two or three times as high as among those in the second division. Although the two divisions were identical, with the exception that students were taught in the first and midwives in the second, he put forward the thesis that perhaps the students carried something to the patients they examined during labour. The death of a friend from a wound infection incurred during the examination of a woman who died of perpetual infection, and the similarity of the findings in the two cases gave support to his reasoning. He concluded that students who came directly from the dissecting room to the maternity ward carried the infection from mothers who had died of the disease to healthy mothers who obviously didn't yet have the disease. He ordered the students to wash their hands in a solution of chlorinated lime before each examination. Under these procedures, the mortality rates in the first division dropped from 18.27 to 1.27%. What a massive decline. And in March and August of 1848, no woman died in childbirth in his division. The younger medical men in Vienna recognised the significance of Semmelweis's discovery and gave him all possible assistance. His superior, on the other hand, was critical, not because he wanted to oppose him, but because he failed to understand him. Second important point to note, I would suggest, is that statement right there. He failed to understand him. Had a preconceived notion about what he thought and what he thought this man was saying, and wasn't really listening to what he actually was saying. In the year 1848, a liberal political revolution swept Europe, and Semmelweis took part in the events in Vienna. After the revolution had been put down, Semmelweis found that his political activities had increased the obstacles to his professional work. So here we go, another important point. The introduction of politicisation to the practice of medicine. In 1849, he was dropped from his post at the clinic. He then applied for a teaching post at the university in midwifery, but was turned down. Soon after that, he gave a successful lecture at the Medical Society of Vienna entitled The Origin of Perpetual Fever. At the same time, he applied once more for the teaching post, but although he received it, there were restrictions attached to it that he considered humiliating. He left Vienna and returned to Pest in 1850. He worked for the next 6 years at the St. Rochus Hospital in Pest. While there, an epidemic of perpetual fever had broken out in the obstetrics department, and, at his request, Semmelweis was put in charge of the department. His measures promptly reduced the mortality rate, and in his years there, it averaged only 0.85%. In Prague and Vienna, meantime, the rate was still from 10 to 15%. You think, like, you're reading the story and you're thinking, man, surely this would be enough for people to at least ask, what is this man getting right here? But no, it wasn't. In 1855, he was appointed professor of obstetrics at the University of Pest. He married, had 5 children, and developed his private practice. His ideas were accepted in Hungary, and the government addressed a circular to all district authorities ordering the introduction of the prophylactic methods of Semmelweis. In 1857, he declined the chair of obstetrics at the University of Zurich. Vienna remained hostile toward him, and the editor of the, and I'm probably going to butcher this here, the Wiener Medizinische Wochenschrift, apologies, as you can tell, that is not my native tongue. The editor of that magazine, though, wrote that it was time to stop the nonsense about the chlorine hand wash. So there you go. You have a public and very much, you'd have to say, a very basic kind of media ridiculing of the man and the therapies that he was proposing. In 1861, Semmelweis published his principal work, and again, let me butcher this for you, Die Etiologie der Begriff und die Prophylaxis des Kindbettfiebers. So that's probably not too bad, I think, actually, but all the German speakers are currently choking on their strudel. Is that a correct stereotypical analogy? I'm not sure. But anyway, let me give you the translation. The work was called The Etiology, Concept, and Prophylaxis of Childbed fever. So it's not fever at all. That's not even any language, fever. He sent it to all the prominent obstetricians and medical societies abroad, but the general reaction was adverse. The weight of authority stood against his teachings. So there you go. Consensus. Expert consensus says no, this man is wrong, and he shouldn't be listened to. He addressed several open letters to professors of medicine in other countries, but to little effect. So he's publishing publicly and doing his best to implore others to follow his example and to at least consider what he's saying, and he's being rejected. At a conference of German physicians and natural scientists, most of the speakers, including the pathologist Rudolf Virchow, rejected his doctrine. The years of controversy gradually undermined his spirit. In 1865, he suffered a breakdown and was taken to a mental hospital where he died. Ironically, his illness and death were caused by the infection of a wound on his right hand, apparently the result of an operation that he had performed before being taken ill. He died of the same disease against which he had struggled all of his professional life. Semmelweis's doctrine was subsequently accepted by medical science. His influence on the development of knowledge and control of infection was hailed by Joseph Lister, the great Joseph Lister, the father of modern antiseptics, in the following way, and let me quote to you from Joseph Lister to finish out this little biography. I think, with the greatest admiration of him and his achievement, and it fills me with joy that at last he is given the respect due to him. Here endeth the story. And that's a true story. All of that happened. I think this is an extremely powerful reminder, an extremely prescient and important true story. And by the way, it's not the only one of this kind throughout our history, for the times in which we currently find ourselves living. It is a powerful story that reminds us that although expert consensus can be valuable, it is not infallible. Absolutely not. It is an important story that reminds us that we all have our blind spots, our biases, and that often our blind spots and biases can take prominence over actual evidence or even a willingness to even contemplate or investigate the evidence. It's a reminder of how, even amongst the expert classes, there are often rivalries, and I guess you'd have to say certain norms that have to be conformed to, certain social conventions within the group that must be upheld, even at the cost of genuine patient care and a really true open and honest examination of all of the data. It's a powerful reminder that in a time of great crisis where you have a pandemic of sorts, you have an extremely serious situation with disease that is claiming a lot of lives, that even in that situation that there can be a certain hubris that develops effectively, that people can assume that they know more than they actually do. In many ways, you'd have to say that this is a kind of a novel condition for these people, in a sense. I mean, it's been happening for a while, but it's, in a sense, that they don't know, just like a novel virus today, we don't know a lot about it because it's new to us. There's still more to learn, but those who are unwilling to accept that fact and who want to entrench themselves in a notion that consensus is infallible, it's above reproach, can put themselves in a position of real danger. Now, not always. As I said, consensus can be a very valuable tool, but it is not infallible. It is not infallible. Being an expert, I think, gives you knowledge that is and certainly can be very, very important to understanding and to the well-being and benefit of society. But It doesn't mean that your expert knowledge is free from the other rational corruptions that any human being is vulnerable to, regardless of their qualifications. You know, your expert knowledge about an issue does not stand alone from you, the person who possesses that knowledge and who might do the work in that particular arena. And so therefore, again, your own biases and your own, blind spots will also have a bearing on how you handle and engage with the knowledge you possess and, I guess, the specialty discipline in which you're engaged in. There's so much that's profound about this story for our times. So much that is profound. And I think that the real challenge here is not to become harsh, unbending, and irrational skeptics, really, who are, I think, are cynics, basically, who just don't accept the voice of experts, who believe that any expert and all experts and all forms of consensus are invalid and corrupted by conspiracy theories and nefarious plots and plans. You know, that is obviously plots and plans. That sounded like pots and pans. I didn't intend to. I just realized I'm a poet and I didn't even know it. But that sort of extreme is very unhealthy and it's not helpful to us. It's a kind of irrationality in and of itself. Of course, the other extreme to that, though, is also a form of irrationality, and that is to imbue consensus and expertise with a sort of almost divine infallibility, an infallibility and an inability to be perhaps corrupted by bias, by blind spots, by social prejudice, by social conventions, by social pressures that go upon you. I've been thinking a bit about this lately and a lot of people talking about, you know, doing your research. And there's been a few memes flying around making jokes about the fact that, you know, often people apparently who are vaccine hesitant are not really doing their research, because what doing your research actually means is, and then the memes will list a whole lot of very extremely serious technical scientific research methods and tools and other things that a researcher in science might go through. But the irony, of course, in that is that in actual fact, I think not only is it a lot of people who have just said, well, I'm going to make a choice, or I'm going to be, let's say someone who says, I'm going to get vaccinated, I'm going to be really hostile towards those who are uncertain or who are choosing not to be vaccinated, is that in actual fact, a lot of people in that group haven't done their research either. They've just accepted ideas that have come down to them from others. So none of us is immune to this. And in fact, it's not just that, but I was thinking, the more I thought about this, I thought, well, I wonder how many experts are actually just repeating ideas, because if I understand the world of science correctly from my readings of the practice of science and how things work in the sort of the research arena, there's actually only a very, very small group of people who are really doing the research, if you like, that's often replicated ad nauseum. It's not like every time an expert comes across a piece of research, they stop and re-examine it and re-research it for themselves to confirm that what's being transmitted to them is accurate. So it's a fascinating sort of critique in and of itself, actually. In a sense, in order to live in society, we have to have a certain amount of trust, don't we, in our experts and expert consensus. But I think in order for that trust to be maintained in a healthy kind of way, it must never, ever fall into the irrationalities of either extreme cynicism or the irrationalities of applying an infallibility to those who have expert knowledge and an infallibility to consensus on something. Like I said, very, very important man, Ignaz Semmelweis. We owe him a great debt, but he suffered greatly. And what he did was showed true courage and true heroism in the face of great adversity, rejected by the professional class, the elites, the technical consensus, the educated consensus, the expert consensus of his day, rejected him outright and ridiculed him in the harshest terms. Little pockets here and there picked up what he was saying, but by and large, he was looked down upon and considered to be a kook, effectively, who was proposing quackery and, you know, all sorts of dangerous ideas, right? A very familiar story, very important story for us in the times that we find ourselves living in. So there you go. Ignaz Semmelweis, a man for our times. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you next time on The Dispatches. The Dispatches podcast is a production of Left Foot Media. If you enjoyed this show, then please help us to ensure that more of this great content keeps getting made by becoming a patron of our work at patreon.com/leftfootmedia. Link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. See you next time on The Dispatches.